the stuff that Bentley and Reuter have done, and it's the stuff which Tim Morris pioneered, where you don't have to fix the gauge. So here's some of the literature for the latter. So Tim started the game off here with this paper, and then there's a sequence of papers. So in this one, it was kind of the idea was presented, but there was no regularization in place. Then the regularization was incorporated here, but it wasn't really an appropriate form to do calculations beyond one loop. Then it was understood how to do calculations beyond one loop, and finally it was all adapted to QCD. And once that was done, there were a number of applications. So this one's somewhat outside the main development, but it's very interesting. There was a link made between the regularization that I'll introduce for this approach and the ADS-CFT correspondence. And then there were some papers that I did on, well, developing a sort of a universal calculus and doing some computations, some general computations without gauge fixing. And on the other side of things, with the approach pioneered by Vetterich, there's these two reviews which detail that, so I won't be talking about that any further in this talk. So just, this is the main...
We'll try to get it...
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Darker, so to see.
Yeah, it's okay.
But then we have to.
I think it's too dark.
Yeah, I think kind of better if you don't know. It's a static tool. Yeah.
Okay, right. These are good problems.
It's at three stages.
So the main tool for constructing these exact RGs where you don't need to fix the gauge is to exploit this blocking freedom, whereby one writes very general exact RGs in the following form. So just as before, it's got this structure with the total derivative here so that the partition function is invariant under the flow. In other words, the partition function flows into the total, the integral of the total derivative. This object here is what defines our exact RG. So it parameterizes the blocking procedure, and there's a huge freedom in its precise form, and it's this freedom which allows us to compute without gauge fixing. So for scalar field theory, we made this choice, and I'll come back to how you generalize this later. And just to recall, so these guys were the ERG kernels, and they incorporate the cutoff functions, making sure everything's regularized in the ultraviolet. And this sigma was this combination here of the Wilsonian effect of action S and the seed action. It's got to contain S so that this equation, so that the flow equation is nonlinear in S. And the seed action, well, it's a non-universal input controlling the flow, so this is the idea that you're starting your flow here, you're ending your flow here. These are the important things. How it gets there doesn't really matter in the seed action. Different choices of seed action will correspond to different paths between the two points. So it's got the same structure and symmetries as the Wilsonian effect of action. And in scalar field theory, you can just take the kinetic term, but this becomes, you have to generalize this in Yang-Mills. So here's the outline. So I'll start with the motivation of why it's useful, well, why it's interesting to do this procedure without gauge fixing. Talk about some technicalities of actually implementing it, and then formulate a manifestly gauge invariant exact RG. So the problem, so a common plot. This is just a sketch of the QCD coupling constant here versus energy. And of course, there's this separation of scales that you've got round about lambda QCD. You've got, of course, the description of quarks and gluons here, and hadrons here. And the fact that you've got the separation of scales suggests that this might be a very natural problem to use the exact RG to describe, because after all, this is something where you're going from one scale to another and seeing how the physics changes as you do this. So why use the ERG? Well, there's some general characteristics that make it useful to attack this problem. First of all, that it's intrinsically non-perturbative. So one can hope to really address this non-perturbative problem of how one gets the hadrons appearing in QCD. And it also allows one to work directly with renormalized variables. So we know that we're going to have some flow which is coming out of the Gaussian fixed point along the relevant directions. And as I've emphasized in other lectures, we can exploit self-similarity to write everything in this form. So in the case of pure Yang-Mills, in fact, we just have one coupling, and as I'll discuss, no anomalous dimension. And you can write the action directly in terms of the coupling renormalized at the scale lambda. So the renormalization is taken care of automatically. There's no need to introduce counterterms and so forth. So those are general characteristics, but there's this amazing added benefit that you can construct manifestly gauge invariant exact RGs, and consequently you can perform calculations without fixing the gauge. So having said that I'm going to do everything without fixing the gauge, I'll just discuss gauge fixing and why it's usually performed and how we can get around it. So of course we know that the partition function contains the integral over all field configurations, and there's a redundancy here. in gauge theory, namely that there's an infinite number which are gauge equivalent. So gauge fixing, one picks, or at least tries to pick, and it's a non-trivial problem to do this, a unique representative for each orbit. So what I've got is a little sketch here. So this whole space is the space of all possible gauge configurations. These are typical gauge orbits, and this is a space of representative configurations. And the reason why this can sometimes be awkward is because it's possible, in principle, for these orbits to loop round and puncture this surface twice, which makes it difficult to decide whether you really are picking a unique representative for each orbit. And this is the problem of Grybov copies. So why fix the gauge in the first place? Well, I think the real reason at Harvard is it allows one just to define the gluon propagator. And so once you've done that, you can compute Green's functions, at least in perturbation theory. And of course, one has the typical Feynman diagram expansion that this procedure allows you to generate. So this seems entirely fundamental to how one computes stuff in QCD. So given this, you might well ask, well, is there anything at all that you can even compute without fixing the gauge? And the answer is, of course, yes. And for a start, you can compute physical observables, hadron-hadron scattering. And this is intuitive in some sense from a non-perturbative perspective, where you're really interested in the interaction of colorless objects. And in fact, this is routinely exploited on the lattice. And more generally, and certainly from the perspective of this talk, one can compute the Wilsonian effect of action without gauge fixing. Obviously, I'll discuss how to do that. And the expectation value of gauge invariant operators. So we have this choice of whether to fix the gauge or not to fix the gauge. And once you ask the question, you know, the standard techniques seem perfectly reasonable and give very good results for a lot of stuff. So why bother not fixing the gauge and developing this whole new formalism? Well, there's a few technical advantages. And the first one, which is quite simple to see, is that the gauge field doesn't renormalize. And so the anomalous dimension is zero. And one can see this as follows. So the gauge transformation law is this. So omega is my gauge parameter. And what I've done here is I've scaled the coupling out of the gauge field. So I've got rid of the overall G here. And once I've done that, I can see that if I now make this rescaling, so this is a field strength renormalization Z, so let's have this. Then what I find is I get a delta A mu over Z equals D mu omega minus I over Z. So now I can just multiply through on both sides by Z here, and I pick up this. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to write this as Z minus 1, and I'm going to add on this bit. So this term here, we just identify as this. And so you can see in these rescaled variables, I've got the original gauge transformation law plus this extra term here. And this tells you that, in fact, this must be forbidden. And so consequently, you can't have any field strength renormalization. And this is spoiled. This argument is spoiled if you've got ghosts in the picture. So if you don't fix the gauge and you rescale to remove the coupling from the connection, then you don't have any anomalous dimension. So that's the first technical advantage. The next one is that the Ward identities take a particularly simple form. And this is just because everything is written just directly in gauge invariant form, manifestly gauge invariant form. And the problem that I discussed on the previous transparency about Grybov copies is entirely avoided. We're not trying to pick out a unique representative of the orbit, so the whole problem of puncturing the plane twice or more just never occurs. And from a more intuitive point of view, one could argue that it's really a natural language for non-perturbative phenomena. So one has this maintenance of manifest gauge invariance. And statements about, for example, confinement can be made entirely independently of the gauge. And this is one of the disadvantages of the approach taken by Reuter and Vetterich, for example. So although they're able to produce statements about phenomena such as this, which is impressive in itself, they are nevertheless gauge-dependent statements that they make. And in principle, at any rate, if you can do a whole study without gauge fixing, it should underlie the other studies that you do when you do fix the gauge. So you could always imagine using this formalism up to a certain point and then fixing the gauge to try to recover other results. So the first of the technicalities that one encounters when trying to do this without fixing the gauge is how to implement a cutoff. So we know that from the other lectures at the very heart of the exact RG is the implementation of a cutoff. This is the fundamental to the whole approach. But if one just naively implements a cutoff, then you're going to break gauge invariance. And there's, as I said, two ways around this. So there's what I've called the practical solution, and that's to just accept this breaking of gauge invariance. I mean, after all, once you fix the gauge, that itself breaks the invariance. And you can keep track of the breaking from implementing the cutoff, by using modified Ward identities. So the Ward identities essentially keep track of the fact that you've got this breaking, and you can hope that the effect, or you can arrange things such that the effects of this violation disappear in the limit that you integrate out all the modes. If you could integrate out all the modes, you should recover the physical gauge invariance that you get. So there we go. But this statement is really only true if there's no truncation. So although it's formally correct that if you implement this properly, you really can integrate out all the degrees of freedom, you recover exact gauge invariance. If you perform any truncation, which at some point you're going to have to do to perform a calculation, you'll then find violations of gauge invariance creeping in. And as I said, this is the approach that was pioneered by these guys, Boyd and Betterich. And it's got some real advantages. And that the first is that it's very simple to implement. And crucially, it's actually produced, you know, real sensible non-perturbative results. So despite its drawbacks, it's a very powerful approach. Now, the other way of attacking the problem is what I've called the elegant solution. And the idea here is to covariantize the cutoff. No. Well, I think I'd rather complimentary about their approach. I mean, I'll talk about the disadvantages of this one. I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages to both. And I don't think anyone would argue that this is an extremely elegant idea, but it has its own disadvantages, which I'll discuss in a moment.
You know, Chris is a very elegant gentleman, that's all.
Christoph, okay, right.
Yes.
Yes. So the idea is to utilize the freedom of the exact RG to construct a covariantized blocking procedure which doesn't require gauge fixes. And as I said, this was pioneered by Tim Morris. Now, unlike the approach of Roger and Betterich, which is not so simple to implement, and as we'll see, there's a large algebraic construction that you have to develop to allow you to do this. And perhaps even more importantly is that no non-perturbative physics has been done with this, and this is a big disadvantage of this. Though I should say that some non-perturbative aspects of the framework have been investigated, and it's really a crucial open problem as to how to best to exploit this formalism. So figuring out how to do this is, the problem is, as I said, there's the implementation, which is not so simple. You've got this large scaffolding, and so it's the idea is to figure out how to basically minimize the complication that's caused by this. So if you can minimize the complication somehow, and figure out how to compute with it effectively, then it would become a very powerful tool. But at the moment, it's not understood how best to go about doing this. So I want to talk now about how one actually covariantizes the cutoff. And this will be for SUN gauge theory. And it's based on this paper by Arnone et al. From 2002. So the basic idea, well, there's two steps. So the first thing you want to do is add covariant higher derivatives. So you can take the normal kinetic term here, and just as we did in scalar field theory, you add an inverse cutoff function, but now you have to covariantize this. So rather than just depending on p squared, you've got del squared sitting here. And this is quite a well-known problem with covariant high derivatives. This certainly wasn't done here for the first time. I think Slavnov first developed this scheme. And it turns out that it actually doesn't regularize a set of one-loop divergences. I'm not sure if there's an intuitive explanation for this. It may be that there is, but I'm not aware of it. Well, what I said, I don't know if there's an intuitive way of understanding it, but that might just be my ignorance. But if you just sit down and at one loop, well, you do your power counting and you want to see which diagrams you've regularized, and you find that everything's regularized except for a set of one loop diagrams with up to a certain number of legs, precise number, I forget. And this is just what you get from the analysis. It may well be that there's some intuitive reason why this happens, but I don't know what it is. So
you extend that at the quadratic level, then it amounts to the usual regularization. Plus,
So what do you mean the usual regularization?
Where we just put a cutoff, a cutoff that breaks the gauge symmetry.
So you're expanding this up to quadratic in the gauge field.
So Yeah, so you have a C box square, which is not covariant.
Right, yeah.
Plus a mess.
Yeah.
So you're...
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer is I can't give you, though there may be, an intuitive explanation why this happens. I just know that it does.
Is it due to gauge symmetry, or that the gauge symmetry is not regularized? Or, I mean, the longitudinal modes do propagate. Longitudinal modes do propagate inside finite diagrams, right?
Yes.
So you don't regulate these ones.
Yes, that might be the problem. That might be one of the problems.
But then you would expect that because of the gauge invariance, this divergence is just cancelled. You know, each individual diagram is diverged, but the whole thing should not.
Oh, well, this is just a matter of the moment of regularization. I'm not looking at renormalization, I'm just regularizing.
Yeah.
And, well, okay. Anyway, yeah, I can't say.
But maybe that's the reason, because you don't break gauge invariance, then these longitudinal modes are not regularized.
Yeah, but even if you fix the gauge, you still find the same problem. So.
Really?
Anyway, but yeah, you certainly do. In fact, in this paper, this is done in a gauge fix setting. They just analyze whether this works using standard techniques. Anyway, there are a set of one.
There will be conciliation between the ghost and the. I mean, you can see that this guy diverging, the ghost diverging, the sum of the two not diverging.
Well, as I said, this. Yeah, but one needs to. This is a matter of regularization. Yeah. So, anyway. There are some one-loop divergences which it doesn't regularize, and the solution is to add some Pauli Valance fields to remove these divergences. And this sounds like quite an unwieldy thing to do, but there's actually a very neat way of implementing this. And so what one does is you take the physical SUN gauge theory and you embed it into a spontaneously broken SUN bar N gauge theory, and I'll give the details in a second. And this SUN bar N gauge theory is regularized by covariant high derivatives. So, when you spontaneously break the symmetry, you find that the heady fields that you get from it provide precisely the set of Pauli Valance fields you need to supplement the covariant high derivatives that you've got in there. So I'll talk a little bit about the details of this. So here's the field content for SUN bar N. And so here we've got the defining representation. So this guy here, this curly A, is a super gauge field that's valued in SUN bar N. And it's Hermitian. And it's super traceless. So the super trace replaces the trace of the natural cyclic invariant, and it's defined as the trace of the top block diagonal minus the trace of the bottom block diagonal. So the embedding goes as follows. So this A1 is the physical gauge field. Then what we find is we've got an unphysical copy that comes with wrong sign action. And the reason it comes with wrong sign action is because of the super trace. So rather than having trace F mu nu squared, we've now got a super trace of curly F mu nu squared. And because the super trace has a minus sign for the bottom block diagonal, it's going to pick up a wrong sign action for the A2 field. And we've also got these wrong statistics fermions. These are the ones which are going to give a mass to be for either Pauli Valance regularization. And there's this central term here. So what are the symmetries of SUN bar N gauge theory? Well, first of all, I'm going to discuss a rather curious symmetry, which is no A0. So let me just go back, actually. I'll put this up on the board. I'll put the field content up here. So we've got this curly A, which is the super gauge field. We've got the physical one, the off-diagonal fermions, the unphysical one, and then we've got this A0, which is the central term. So it turns out that this A0 field, we don't want it to appear in the action. And the reason is as follows. So this is how I'm going to write my kinetic term. And there's two features of this which I want to draw attention to. So the first is that we've got this commutator structure, F nu nu just as usual. We've also got that the super trace of 1 is equal to 0, and you can just very straightforwardly check that this means that if you substitute this into the form of the kinetic term, you can check that A0 doesn't actually have a kinetic term itself. So if A0 were to appear anywhere else in the action, it would act as a Lagrange multiplier, which is not what you want. But You can't simply drop it. That shouldn't say action, it's rather just drop it from the entire formalism. But the problem is it's generated by gauge transformation. So if you want to say, I just want to simply remove a zero from my considerations, you can then perform a super gauge transformation and it will regenerate it. So if you want to make sure that the action is really independent of a zero, you have to impose this as an additional constraint. And so these lead to non-trivial constraints. And the nice thing is that although this caused considerable headaches at the beginning when the formalism was being set up, it was later understood that you can essentially just completely forget about this problem if you adopt a convenient and natural diagrammatic prescription, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So this is important to know about, but essentially, if you know how to deal with it, you can forget about it. And the other symmetries are just the local SUN bar N gauge invariants. So this just takes the usual form where this is now an SUN bar N gauge transformation rather than an SUN transformation. So that's the embedding that we've done, but we obviously want to break this symmetry so that we're dealing with the physical SUN, or dealing with a regularization rather of the physical SUN gauge theory. And we just do this in the normal manner, so we introduce a Higgs mechanism, or since we're dealing with SUN bar N, it's a super Higgs mechanism. And so what we want to do is introduce a superscalar C that's valued not in SUN bar N, but in UN bar N. And the reason we want it in UN bar N is because that contains this direction here, this 1 minus 1 direction. And if we arrange for C to acquire a VEV in this direction, then it's going to give a mass to these guys. It's going to commute with these two, but it's not going to commute with either of those. And what this does is it breaks SUN bar N down to its bosonic subgroup. So we've got the physical SUN here, we've got the unphysical one here, and we've got the additional unphysical symmetry that's carried by A0, which I said can essentially be forgotten about for all intents and purposes. So those are the technicalities on how one needs to sort of get out of the way before implementing this in the exact RG. And so here now we can construct the ERG itself. So the strategy is as follows. So we're going to start with just pure U1 gauge theory, because that's the simplest case, and that avoids many of the technicalities. And if we can understand how to do that, we can then add on to that the regularization issues. So in this case, you really can actually regularize it just by a naive cutoff. So as I said, you can understand the basics of how to go about constructing manifestly gauge invariant ERGs, and then generalize this. So here's a flow equation for pure U1 gauge theory. So start off with this equation again. So this is the one I introduced just at the beginning from the other lectures, which is a general form for writing down exact RGs. And for scalar field theory, we previously made this choice, and the flow equation was just this guy here with this classical term, so-called classical term here, and the quantum term here. And for U1 gauge theory, because there's no issues with introducing a cutoff, we just simply trade phi for a mu. So it's going to have exactly the same structure, but with just a mu's appearing everywhere. So here we go. So here is a flow equation for pure U1 gauge theory. These d by da's are gauge invariant on their own. No gauge fixing has been performed in deriving this. And so this is actually a manifestly gauge invariant flow equation. So rather than dealing with that directly, which is fine to do from the point of view U1 gauge theory, there's an additional change that's useful to make for the non-abelian case. And I want to do this rescaling. Oop, and I've... Sorry? I can't. So I'm dealing with U1 gauge theory just as a warm-up, where there's no problem at all with the cutoff. I can just implement it. I can just put in C of P squared. And essentially the reason is that these... Okay. Right, yep. So I want to do this rescaling, and as I mentioned at the beginning, if I do this rescaling, it means that the gauge field won't renormalize. So, as I said, in a non-abelian case, this doesn't renormalize, but I want to do it in the U1 case first, just to get the feeling for the subtlety involved. So if I perform this rescaling here, then I'm going to get an extra term on the left-hand side of the equation, and that's because I started off with a lambda d lambda at constant gauge field, but now what I've done is I've shifted A, or rather I've rewritten A is equal to A prime G squared. And so I'm going to generate an extra term on the left-hand side of the flow equation to compensate for that change. And you can see that this term is going to spoil manifest gauge invariance, because if I perform a gauge transformation, this itself does gauge transform. And so I'm going to be left with something looking like d mu ds by da mu. Now, this term is gauge invariant, but only if we assume that S itself is gauge invariant. In other words, if we assume that P dotted into any of the vertices is zero, then we know that this will give zero, but that's an assumption, so we've lost manifest gauge invariance. And the solution to that, to maintain manifest gauge invariance, is just to actually drop this term from the flow equation. And this seems like a fairly drastic thing to do, and doesn't seem to be, initially you might think that this just doesn't make sense. You can't just drop a term from the flow equation and expect it to make sense. But the point is that the resulting flow equation is... Right, sorry, so I've got this term a mu ds, oops, sorry. So I've got this term here. So if I do a gauge transformation, then I'm going to pick up something which looks like this. Right? Now, this is only gauge invariant if I assume that this is equal to zero. Oh, sorry, where this term comes from. So I want to do this rescaling. I want to rescale A goes to A over G. And the reason for doing that is in the non-abelian case, it means that the gauge field doesn't renormalize. So this, the anomalous dimension is forced to be zero as a consequence of manifest gauge invariance. So this rescaling is a convenient thing for me to do. Sorry? Well, I'm just changing my variables. I mean... No, there's no breaking of gauge invariance here. You want me to work directly in terms of things like f mu squared? Well, that's what I said. Well, no, it's not due to perturbation theory. No, it's not due to perturbation theory. I mentioned it at the beginning of the talk. The reason you want to do this rescaling is because it then means that the gauge field doesn't renormalize. So I can run through the argument again if it's useful to do that. But it's if the gauge field doesn't renormalize, it means you don't have any anomalous dimension. So if you do this rescaling, the anomalous dimension is zero. It's forced to be zero by the manifest gauge invariance. So this is a nice thing to have. So you want to do this rescaling. Sorry, say again? So, well, only if I rescale. No, this rescaling... I've got this. And then I rescale.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's essentially what I'm doing.
Okay, because this is the flag, and this one is, the one that's really the one where it's.
Right, which is what I want to get to. Well. No. I'm saying I'm starting off with a G here, and then I want to get rid of it. Okay. Well, at any rate, we will both agree then on the final form of the flow equation. So in that sense, we'll be happy. So the thing that I wanted to say is you can just drop this term from the flow equation. And the point is that the flow equation is perfectly valid. So we've got this general formalism for flow equations. We wanted to satisfy certain things, that it leaves the partition function invariant, and that it's ultraviolet regularized and so forth. And the flow equation with this thing dropped satisfies all the requirements. It just means that we're using a different blocking functional. So when we have this thing, it's d by d phi, or d by d phi, psi e to the minus s. Dropping that term just corresponds to choosing something different for this guy. So if we now rescale S as follows, so this is the rescaling that Laurent, I think, was wanting to see, and rescale the seed action as well, then we can write the flow equation in this form. So it's exactly the same as before, but with the one difference that this sigma is now written as sigma G, and this is just a consequence of the rescalings. And I should just say in the literature, just to avoid confusion, sometimes the rescaling isn't done on S hat. So often in the literature, at least in some of the earlier papers, sigma G is defined instead to be G squared S minus 2S hat. So that's just to avoid confusion. You might find that in the papers, but it doesn't make any difference. Right, but this is just something, this is an input to the flow equation. So I'm just telling you, right, that if you look at the literature, you'll find that. You might not like it, but you'll find it. Right. So. Okay, so well, I think we can agree that we're both happy with this. Yeah. Right. So I'm now going to discuss the effective propagator, I'll say what it is first. So in scalar field theory, we often found that this was a sensible choice to make. So where this delta dot was equal to minus lambda lambda of the regularized propagator. And so how can this make sense in gauge theory, or rather in this approach to gauge theory? Because we haven't fixed the gauge, and so we don't have a propagator. So how can we have the derivative of some regularized propagator if we never have a propagator in the first place? And the point is that this is just the wrong way of looking at things. So first and foremost, beyond any other considerations, delta dot is an ERG kernel. You can always integrate it with respect to lambda, and the result may or may not be directly identifiable as a propagator. If it is, fine, but if it isn't, it doesn't matter. The point is, it's an ERG kernel regularizing the flow equation. And so for this reason, delta is often called an effective propagator. So it has some of the characteristics which are similar to propagators. In scalar field theory, you might well be able to identify it with one, but there are, in principle, some differences. And one of the reasons for usefully calling it an effective propagator is that diagrammatically, it plays a very similar role in ERG diagrams to the role a propagator plays in normal Feynman diagrams. Now, this can be a bit misleading because the diagrams that one's generating in the ERG aren't Feynman diagrams. They're diagrams which are showing you how the effective action evolves. They're not showing you, or they're not directly showing you the results of scattering processes. So although they're playing a similar role in the diagrams are different, though they look much the same. And so, again, its interpretation can be radically different. And this is precisely the case here where we don't fix the gauge, where we clearly can't interpret it as a propagator in the usual sense. So there's the effective propagator relationship, and this is as follows. So in scalar field theory, we split the action up as follows. So this is essentially the kinetic term, and this is the interaction term. And if, depending on how we choose to normalize this, we can exactly identify this with the kinetic term. But this is the splitting we choose to do. And there's obviously the trivial relationship. This is how I've defined delta minus 1. It's just so that delta minus 1 times delta is equal to 1, as you might expect. Now, if we want to look at pure gauge theory and do a similar splitting, the splitting becomes the following, where we've now got these indices floating around. And I'm going to call this the effective propagator relationship here. And it now becomes non-trivial, because this guy carries indices, but the delta itself doesn't. So. So in the flow equation, I've just got my delta sitting here without any indices. So this is a d by dA mu, d by dA mu. Well, I'm going to introduce this thing in the kinetic term, which does. And the point is that if I contract these into each other now, I get the one as before, but I also get something left over. And this contribution here is called a gauge remainder. And it's called a gauge remainder just because it remains as a consequence of not having fixed the gauge. And just a note, I'm calling this box mu nu. Well, again, I'll write this up. So I'm just defining here box mu nu, T to be this transverse object.
For you, no?
Sorry?
Delta without indices. The delta with no indices is which operator?
Delta, so this would look like, for example, C of P squared over lambda squared. This would be one choice you could make for it. So it would be something like this. And so delta minus, whereas delta minus 1 would be C minus 1 box mu nu. So this would be a sensible choice to make.
the minus one mu nu is.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, thanks. So now move on to the monobeam case. And schematically, at any rate, things look almost exactly the same. So here's the recipe for generating the non-abelian flow equation. So we start from the U1 case, where we've done this rescaling to put G, 1 over G squared in front of the action. But if we want to just take this as our non-abelian flow equation, this won't work anymore, because these D by DAs now do gauge transform. But we know the solution from the discussion of how we regularize things. So what we want to do is we want to do two things. We want to, first of all, embed A mu into this SUN bar N gauge field, curly A mu. We want to incorporate the symmetry breaking so that we're dealing with a regularization of the physical theory. And we also want to covariantize this relationship here. So I've written this out in full, so I've expanded these dots. So this is really a D by DA mu at the point X and a D by DA mu at the point Y. And so one way we could covariantize this is to have Wilson lines, for example, going between X and Y. But often the choice of covariantization isn't specified. As long as one has a covariantization, as long as covariantization exists, and for the formulation of this, I'm happy. Well, so the final expression that I've got is going to be a Lorentz scalar, and it's going to be gauge invariant. Well, I'm in Euclidean space, so it's actually a Lorentz scalar. No symmetries that are broken here.
What do you mean by covariantizing?
Okay, so what I mean by covariantize. Well, could I just introduce the notation on the next transparency and then.
This is a notation, it's not nothing like.
I haven't covariantized anything here, yet. But let me just show the notation and then I can explain a realization of it. So the manifestly gauge invariant flow equation is as follows. So here it is. So this involves the super gauge field, A mu, and this is the symmetry breaking gauge field. Notice that the fields come with different kernels. That's why I've got these labels here. And these curly brackets denote covariantization of the kernel. So what I can take this to mean is if I've got this for some kernel W, then I'm going to have some sum. Let me put that in a minute. So it's going to be something of this form. So I'm going to have a U, a point X, then I'm going to have, let's call this X1, up to Xn, then I'm going to have a V, point Y, and an A U of Y1,
Don't do the general case. There's too many fields already.
Too many what? Well, let me just finish.
Just two fields. Where is omega? Is it A?
What? I'm sorry.
Just take one example with A. What do you mean by covariating? Where is omega?
W. This is some general kernel.
Which one?
Well, okay. Let me take it.
Let me take
this guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I've got here, let me start with this. Okay, so I've got the integrals over dx and dy, so that's this guy and this guy. I've then got the integrals over dx1 to xn, which is these coordinates, which would be an xn, and dy1 to dyn, that's these coordinates. And then I've got the vertices. So the vertices are going to be written as x, y, but I've always got the coordinates x and y, x1 to xn. So that's
where
that's
delta, that. Where is delta?
So oh, sorry.
So what was delta dot in the beginning?
So that is my definition of what I mean by covariantization. So in other words, I started off with something like this, the way it thinks.
I'm lost. Delta dot initially is an operator that depends only on x and y.
So delta, an example of delta dot. So delta, well.
If you take delta dot, you can use cp divided by p, or whatever.
Yeah, it would be c
So it's an operator. It depends only on x and y.
Right.
X and y. Okay.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by delta dot xy, the derivative?
Sorry? The derivative. What's the derivative?
Okay. Delta dot xy, comma, blah, blah, blah.
Sorry. These are just arguments, yeah. There's no derivative. This is just a set of arguments.
Find that guy? Okay, so what's the definition of that guy?
Of this guy? Well, this then depends on the choice of covariantization. So what we've got is we're going to have...
This is what I'm asking.
So delta dot of xy... Naught, if you like, will be this thing. Right? And then these guys, the other guys, are just the vertices, and you can determine some general constraints on them just by gauge invariance. So if I now do a super gauge transformation on this, then I'm going to get constraints on the various vertices. So you know, just in the usual case, when you've got some action which has some vertices, and you can deduce the order identities by doing a gauge transformation.
No, but you had an operator, which is delta, which is the kernel, depends on x.
And I'm just saying now it's got this.
So now you define some operation of covariantization, which depends on defining an infinite number of new fields arbitrarily.
Pretty much, yes.
Okay.
So I could choose a specific realization. So let me just finish.
So delta dot is arbitrary.
Delta dot, I'm going to choose to be this, right?
The zero one, but then there's so the
these ones, well, they're not entirely arbitrary, no, because if I now do a gauge transformation, so I can always do a gauge transformation, right? And so this means that these aren't entirely arbitrary, because this is going to give a set of constraints, just like normal, just as in the normal way, the vertices of the action are related.
So what is the constraint you ask, that when you make a gauge transformation, this guy doesn't change?
This whole expression doesn't change. So,
do you have okay? Is there one solution? Is there many solutions?
There's many different solutions one could take for this.
And where's the index here? Mu one and mu n for xn. Where did it contract?
Oh, sorry. Sorry. You're right. This should be a mu one. Yes, I've got the b's here.
Yeah.
So,
and they're contracted with what?
Yes. Sorry. This should have indices as well. So mu one. Look, I think a way to think about it is that...
Do you have a prescription for it, or...?
Well, there are prescriptions that exist, yeah. I mean,
can you give me one example?
So I can take... Actually, examples of vertices off the top of my head, no, I couldn't. But an example that you might take is you might want this to be... So if I've got... if I'm going to take u to be transforming the bifundamental with indices I, j, k, l, something like this, then we'll have some index flow like this. We've got a Wilson line, which will carry, I don't know which way around the indices go, but from I to L. And then we'll have one coming back down the other way from J to K.
So that's the usual. Okay, so if you put a Wilson line, you can covariantize, but then you have to break Lorentz symmetry.
Well, yeah, but I can just integrate over all possible Wilson lines.
What do you mean by
I'm going to introduce some measure. There's no loops here, but I need to take it straight.
What? Straight line. Yeah, but that's an old problem that you can't, you know, this is Migdal problem, that you can't have a nice measure which is well defined on the sets of loops.
There's no loop set.
You're assuming the existence of something that people have tried to construct for many, many years explicitly with lots of problems.
Well, I'm not sure that anyone's trying to bother. I don't think the constructor's been with regard to this particular problem. I mean, if you want to look at the specific realization, I think the best I can do now is just to point you to the literature. And I'm not going to be able to just write this up on the board off the top of my head. But
Your comment is clear, right? It's that you're afraid that this procedure of covariantization might lead to problems with Lorentz.
I'm not even sure I understand what you mean by covariantization. So suppose I break Lorentz lines. What do you mean by having Wilson lines? So I have an operator. I'm not sure what you mean. I have an operator like that. But I thought your operator was. So your operator is not VG Lorentz.
Well, what do you mean? I mean, there's no gauge field here. I can't do a gauge transformation.
Right, it's not a function, so this guy is the matrix element of an operator C, it depends on which condition, the covariant condition or the non-covariant, the non-covariant condition.
Okay. And then you want to cover an integer. So that's, yeah. How do you do it? This is one of the fundamental problems of transmitting regularization. So when you say you put width and lines.
One example.
What do you mean? Yeah, but even one example. So what do you mean?
Anyway, the question is clear. Maybe we can go on and.
The globalization is to replace. One way to provide that is to have an established is to replace these guys by bots.
Right, sure.
So that's what you mean?
Well, that's one thing you can do.
Okay, fine.
No, but that's not the issue because I know how to supplement the regularization. I'm just doing everything in SUN bar N.
Oh, so why don't you start with that?
Okay, well, you can if you want to. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with choosing that. I mean, I think the point I'm trying to make is just that for my purposes, I don't mind what the co-variantization is. As long as one exists, I'm happy and I'm not going to specify it because for many calculations, the details make no difference.
Well, I guess, but you still want some regulating, no? Or you
have the regularization is encoded in this guy. This one I am going to choose something for, the delta of x, y, naught on the naught.
Okay, but how do you, so I'm confused, because you could have started there by saying I put a covariant guy and everybody would have, but you started by saying there's a problem in doing so. There's a problem in putting a delta dot, which is covariant, so that it doesn't regularize. So. Why now are we... I thought your initial point was that the nice thing you should do is just do the usual stuff, put a covariant delta. And
right.
That would have been fine with me.
Yeah.
But then you say it doesn't work because it doesn't regulate.
Right.
But now you say...
It doesn't regulate entirely. We're going to this embedding in SUNN. That's all.
So it regulates up to a set of one-loop divergences, which I know how to cure if I put everything in spontaneously broken SUN bar N. So, what I want to do is rather than taking...
So the idea is the broken, it's not this. Yeah.
Yeah, so I embed a spontaneously broken SUN bar N and apply covariant hyperdimensional regularization to that. And then the combination of the SUN bar N invariants and the covariant higher derivatives makes sure that everything's regularized and everything's covariant.
The combination of what makes
the sense? The SUN bar N invariants, or the spontaneously broken SUN bar N. So the combination of that and the covariantization means that everything's regularized and everything's covariant.
Why? Can you explain how this one loop thing disappeared?
What you've got is the spontaneously broken SUN bar N gives you a set of Pauli Villars fields. And they are precisely the set of Pauli Villars fields you need to cancel the one loop divergences. I mean, I don't think I could, that's not something one can just do on the board. I mean, you have to go through.
But then you get more fields. You get an extra copy of SUN and an extra copy of SUN.
Right, yeah. Sure. So this goes back to the problem I was saying at the beginning, which is...
It looks like taking a big hammer to, scratch...
Well, have you got another way to do manifestly gauge invariant calculations in the continuum? I mean, if you have, great, because you could get rid of this. Get rid of the construction. I mean, as I said at the beginning, the problem with this is that it's got the advantages that you do have manifest gauge invariant. You've got this extra cluster that comes with it, and the challenge is figuring out how to minimize the pain that the cluster causes you.
So you double the number of fields to get rid of.
More than double the number of fields.
But the problem is that we did not see why there was a divergence in the first place, so it's impossible to see why it's regulated now. It looks the same. So what is it? Mm-hmm.
So these curly brackets, so forget about the curly AU. Curly brackets incorporate the covariant hyperderivatives. So fine, take this form.
Yeah.
Right. We know that we don't expect that to regularize one loop divergences.
Yeah.
And we know the solution is to embed everything in SUN bar N, spontaneously broken SUN bar N.
So why is it the solution?
Why is it the solution? Yeah. Right. Well, so the way it was originally discovered is that the analysis was done with just the covariant higher derivatives, and you find a set of divergences, right? So you then say, okay, I'm going to put in some Pauli-Villars field. So I put in a Pauli-Villars field, and I get rid of one, but another fit. And I keep doing this procedure until I've got the set of Pauli-Villars fields that I need so that everything's regularized. It was then noticed that you could very efficiently get the exact set of fields, Pauli-Villars fields you need by embedding it in SUN, spontaneously breaking SUN bar N. So it was just a very nice trick for generating the correct set of Pauli Galois fields.
And those VFs are the Pauli Galois fields in the end?
Essentially, yes.
Can you show the appear, maybe, you know, the Pauli Galois field? So if you had one Pauli Galois field, how you would add it?
Okay, so. Yeah, sure. Okay, so if you've got. That's pretty useful to keep up with where it runs on this side of the route. So,
there's one big.
Sorry?
So there's an intermediate one. There's an intermediate
one. How do I get to it? I see. Right, okay, yeah. Right, so if you've got, so let's suppose that I've got some diagram, some one loop diagram, I'll do it in ERG notation, so this is just a vertex here. And these curly lines will be A1, so this is an A1 mu and A1 mu, and I'm going to have A1 flowing around here. Right. And what I'll also have is I'll also have a diagram like this, with S, A1 mu, and now A1 mu. And these guys, this will be a, well, let me put the fields in here actually. So I've got an A1, whereas here what I'm going to have, I'm going to have a B, B bar, B bar, B. Now, the point is, if I look at the group theory of this, the group theory is actually very easy to do it by using the SUN bar N stuff, because I know that if I've got supertrace over 1, this is equal to plus n. And that's what I've got in this diagram. So this is going to give me an overall factor of n. And the point is that the wrong statistics of these guys will give me a minus n. Now, these internal lines basically become the same in the high momentum limit. Right, so
do these, this other connection?
So the B's are these.
Both connection or the other
connection? Yes. So these guys here. These are these fermionic fields. So this thing.
Okay.
Yep.
The A bar also something works.
Sorry, A?
A bar.
A bar.
The other A.
Oh,
A2.
Yeah, so you actually need that field in there as well. That provides part of the regularizing structure that you actually need.
But actually for this diagram...
But this diagram, you don't need it. But
you don't have a third term, which is the A2 which flows? So you have a third term?
Yes, sure, you do. Yes. But I just want to talk about how this one here... Well, actually, for this one, you don't, because... No, you don't, right. And the reason is easy to see, because I can't have it by group theory, because if I have a super trace... So let me call this one. No, what should I call this?
A1.
I'll call this. Well, it doesn't matter. Let me just write it out. So I've got A1, A2, A2 alpha. So this would be the vertex that I need. Right. So I've got an A1 here, and an A2, and an A2. The point is this lives in the upper block diagonal, and this guy lives in the lower block diagonal. So what I'm going to have, like, I'm going to have an A1, naught, times a naught. A2. So in fact, this vertex vanishes. Just from the group theory. And basically, the reason that you need this A2, again, it's all the group theory essentially sorts out an additional set of cancellations, which are more elaborate than this. So, as we discussed, that denotes the covariantization of the kernel. And the seed action is, of course, required for an interaction term. So that's just a consequence of gauge invariance on the one hand. So you can't just have a two-point term, you've got to have a three-point term and a four-point term at least. But in fact, turns out, for technicalities that I'm not going to get into, you need a more general seed action even than that. And so not only do you have more fields, more than double number of fields, you've got a complicated seed action, and you've got this covariantization. So here is a summary, then, of the non-universal details. So the structural elements, you've got the seed action, you've got the cutoff functions, and you've got the details of how you covariantize the cutoff functions. The unphysical fields, you've got fields with mass at the scale lambda, so that's B, and C and D were just the components of the superscalar that was breaking the symmetry. You've got the massless A2 field, and you've also got this funny central field, which doesn't appear in the action. So given that you've got this huge amount of junk in here, including even a massless field, there's a crucial question, and that is, how do we ensure that we're really dealing with the physical SUN Yang Mills, and not just some hodgepodge of God only knows what? And so here's how you guarantee that you're dealing with a physical theory. So the key concept, so first of all, the partition function is invariant under the flow. So if we know that we're describing physics at one scale, then no matter how obscure this becomes at lower scales, we know that we're describing physics at the lower scales too. So if we write the action in self-similar form, then this is another way of saying that we're on a renormalized trajectory. So in self-similar form, we're on a renormalizable trajectory, and the theory in the ultraviolet is automatically controlled by the Gaussian fixed point. So we're guaranteed to be dealing with a physical SUN theory everywhere along the flow if we're dealing with the physical theory in the ultraviolet, and of course if the flow is well defined. So if we can ensure these two things, then we are actually dealing with just a regularization of the physical theory along the flow rather than just some random junk. So given that we've got a massless field, there's the issue of decoupling. So in the ultraviolet, as lambda tends to infinity, these guys become infinitely massive, so they decouple, and there's nothing to worry about. This field, this A mu 2, the unphysical copy that sits here, it remains massless, but it decouples. And the point is that A1 and A2 only communicate via these heavy fields. So I can integrate them out, and I can ask what's the lowest dimension gauge invariant operator that I can construct. And this is the lowest dimension gauge invariant operator I can construct that links A1s and A2s. And again, it comes back to the point I was just making a minute ago, that they've got to be in separate traces. Otherwise, I'm going to get zero. And the point is that this is irrelevant in any dimension. And so A2 and A1 are going to decouple as lambda goes to infinity. So the result of this is if we pose a question about the physical theory at effective scale, then all the other fields are providing regularization and nothing more. And this is particularly clear in actual calculations. And the reason I say that you pose a question about the physical theory, because you could equally pose a question about A2. Why you'd want to is another matter. You could if you wanted to. And in fact, well, the thing about it becoming clear in real calculations, basically my external fields, like this, are physical A fields. And then I can just see that everything else is providing regularization. So how do we ensure a well-defined flow? So this is the other thing, the other requirement that we need. So first of all, and this is a crucial ingredient of ExactRG, blocking takes place only over a localized patch. So when I'm averaging over variables, I want a very rapid fall-off with distance. And the consequence of this is that long-range interactions only appear as the effective scale goes to zero.
So is it because the U1 or any step?
Sorry?
The U1. There's an extra U1 here.
Right.
So what happened to it?
So as I said, I'll come back to that. So I said when I mentioned at the beginning that one can effectively forget about it if you adopt a very convenient diagrammatic prescription. Didn't tell you what that diagrammatic prescription was, but I will in a couple of transparencies time. So
it doesn't decouple.
It just doesn't appear. So I put in I use a constraint that says it never appears in action. So it automatically doesn't have a kinetic term, basically because the supertrace 1 is 0, essentially, and also 1 can be 0. It doesn't have a kinetic term. You then demand that it doesn't appear anywhere else in the action, which requires a set of constraints. You can then figure out the effect of these constraints, and it's not trivial, but the net result is that it maps you into, well, as I'll discuss it explicitly in a couple of transparencies, so you come back to that.
But it doesn't
appear.
The equation you wrote before, the Puchinsky equation.
Right.
Does it satisfy these constraints?
This is a pretty non-trivial thing, and this is one of the aspects which held up development for quite a long time, because I think you missed it at the very beginning, but I was saying that originally there was one form of the flow equation that was used, and it was found that you could compute to one loop. You could compute to any number of loops, but you could only efficiently compute to one loop. And the problem was generalizing the flow equation so that you could compute conveniently to any number of loops. And the real problem with generalizing the flow equation was satisfying this symmetry.
So what did you... So you didn't talk about that. You wrote something...
That would be a seminar in itself.
No, but okay. Previously, it seemed that whatever you wrote... So you wrote the general equation. Are you claiming... The general equation.
Flow equation.
So is the question is that all these equations preserve these constraints?
No, certainly not. The one I wrote down does.
So what is the condition in your equation that you wrote which You can go on your transparency. There was a transparency of the equation. With this.
Well, the condition comes down to constraints on this guy.
No, but this guy is covariant. So let's take C of box. Let's work with C of box.
Right, so you've got some constraint, which is that the action is invariant under delta A equals 1 times some parameter lambda. And you just substitute that in, and you get a set of identities.
So for instance, this covariantization, is it or is it not?
This one, I think it is, actually. But I can't remember off the top of my head. I think that one is.
Why?
Well, I mean, it's something you need to check. But I can't remember off the top of my head. I think it does. I can't remember. But it's a symmetry
you've
got.
It's a Laplacian, so I got an a square times a Casimir. So clearly there's a diagonal part. I think it's linked to the equation, is that maybe you're hiding a lot, is that, you know, if you tell me this is a covariantization, I can buy it.
Yep.
Now, if this guy satisfies the symmetry, that's fine with me. If he does not, then I'm back to the problem of, well, does it exist? You know,
well, I'm afraid I just can't remember off the top of my head. I think it does, but I can't remember.
Okay.
Now, you have to just go back and check the literature afterwards, but the point is you have a set of constraints which your covariantization must obey. It must obey gauge invariance, and it must obey this no A0 symmetry. Those are the constraints it has to satisfy, and you have to find something which satisfies both of them. That's what
we're saying. If I take this one, the Laplacian, the covariant Laplacian is not invariant over this sheet, right? So this one is not a symmetry of the covariant Laplacian. Now, if I have a function which is not...
Well, don't forget that you've got the symmetry. Don't forget you've got the symmetry sitting up. Side there, super trace of 1, 0. So I'd rather discuss this afterwards when I can actually get the literature and answer it directly, because I'm not going to be able to just.
No, but not the technique, just the idea. The question is that, I mean, any function which is Lorentz invariant and scalar invariant is just going to be a function of this covariant Laplacian. Okay, so what you call covariantization is any function like a box square. So now.
Well, I can go with something more general. I can say this is my general form, and this will imply a set of identities on this guy here.
Well, it's a function. Okay, you can be more general. I mean, right, it's a function of box and f, or whatever. So the question is whether there exists one guy that satisfies all your requirements, and you're saying...
Right.
So if I take just a function of box, just a function of box doesn't work, right? Because the Laplacian is not invariant under that guy, or you're saying it does.
I'm saying I think it'd be far more productive to discuss this after the lecture when I can actually get the paper and answer it directly rather than guessing on my feet. But there is an example of a covariantization in the literature which exists.
But it's not a dead form, or is it?
Let me tell you when I finish the talk. So I've got this requirement that blocking takes place over a localized patch. So the long-range interactions only appear when you've integrated out all degrees of freedom. And one way of implementing this, or an equivalent statement, is that each exact RG step, each infinitesimal step, is free of infrared divergences. And to ensure this, one requires, and this is another requirement, that all ingredients of the flow equation have an all-orders derivative expansion. And this in the literature is called the requirement of quasi-locality. It doesn't necessarily ensure locality, hence the quasi. So locality itself, well, we know that the action is self-similar. I've demanded this, so that the physics in the ultraviolet is then determined by the Gaussian fixed point. A partition function is invariant under the flow. So if I'm dealing with the local physics in the ultraviolet, then I'm guaranteeing that I'm dealing with the correct local physics along the flow. So, right, so the real lesson from that is that my partition function being invariant under the flow and the fact that I'm coming along a renormalized trajectory out of the fixed point are really crucial elements to this construction. But now discuss what the bare action is in this case. So from lecture one, we discussed that the bare action is something which we compute if we're flowing out of the fixed point. So we specified that we're at it, we specified which fixed point we're at, we specified the rates at which we're flowing out of the relevant directions, and so the bare action we computed. And just to recall this piece of lattice terminology, it's often called the bare action in this context, called the perfect action in the vicinity of the UV fixed point. So, when computing the universal quantity, so things you could actually measure and experiment, we can leave, at least in principle, the non-universal details arbitrary. So details, for example, with covariantization, if we could really calculate some quantity without doing a truncation or whatever, then these details would be guaranteed to cancel out. So by not explicitly choosing the seed action, the cutoff functions, or the details of these covariantizations, we're implicitly working with an infinite number of bare actions. So we never specify what bare action is, we never compute it, it's just an infinite class which will satisfy the equations. So to actually extract physics from these equations, one needs renormalization conditions. You need to say what it is that you actually mean by the coupling G. And we can exploit self-similarity to do this. So I'm just going to write the action for the A1 sector in this form. This just defines what I mean by 1 over G squared. 1 over G squared is just the number in front of a half trace F1 squared. But the problem is that we need a second renormalization condition because A2 carries its own coupling. And because we're in spontaneously broken phase, there's no symmetry which says that these two should renormalize the same. So they're going to renormalize separately.
So is it clear? I mean, you have this highly non-local action.
Well, how?
So is it clear that you don't generate terms which are F1 squared divided by box squared, for instance?
Well, yes, that it is.
So how do you identify?
Right, so what I've demanded is I've demanded that all ingredients of the flow equation have this all orders derivative expansion. So that would immediately exclude the term that you've said.
Oh, but is it something which is satisfied? I mean, the equation is the equation.
Yes.
So.
Okay, so the equation.
You're saying the equation never generate non-local terms? Or?
No, so I'm not saying that as such. So what I'm saying is that there's ingredients. There's this ingredient, this is something I choose, and there's also S hat, which is something I choose. Right, I can choose those to be quasi-local. Right, I can choose those to have an all-orders derivative expansion. That could nevertheless hide non-local physics. But my argument goes that given this requirement, the requirement of quasi locality will ensure I have a well-defined flow. Self-similarity will ensure that I'm flowing from the fixed point in the ultraviolet. And in the ultraviolet, I know that I'm just dealing with bog-standard, normal, local SUN Yang Mills. So given that the partition function is invariant of the flow, and given that the flow is well-defined, I'm going to claim that I'm dealing with the correct physics along the flow. But if you want me to explicitly demonstrate that to you, that's not something I'd be able to do.
But maybe you're forbidding something that happens. No? A covariant nest term, for instance,
terms like that could be built up. In the limit.
But this one, a covariant nest term cannot be built up by expanding the derivative. And
so, like, you know, it's effectively the guy I get when I, for instance, put my theory in a box, right? So it should be part of the randomization group.
You don't have quasi locality in the limit that lambda tends to zero. In this limit, I don't see why you couldn't generate such terms. But they'd have to be built up as you take this limit, because at any other scale you'd be able to do a derivative expansion. But in the limit that you really iterate everything out, then sure, then I don't see why these things couldn't appear. No, indeed, you'd expect things like that to appear.
I mean, I know that if I put Yang Mills in the box, if I put an infrared cutoff, then I generate a mass term.
Okay.
Which is covariant. And the covariant mass term is exactly F1 over box F. And it's a physical object. I can measure it. It's there. So I imagine that changing the size of the box, which is changing the temperature, you know, should be part of some type of normalization group, because it means it. So I'm not sure that this is true. And maybe, you know, because Yang Mills is a confining theory. And essentially, you can link this appearance of these non-local terms to exactly the property of confinement also.
Right, because if you could, I think this is.
You're assuming always things about the behavior of the theory, which is what we want to
do. Okay, so all I'm assuming is, this isn't an assumption, I'm just demanding that the ingredients of my flow equation have a derivative expansion, and I can choose them to have a derivative, they're the ingredients, so it's just covariantization and the seed action. I'm just going to choose them to have a derivative expansion.
Yeah, but my flow can just break, before I go to the fixed point, I can just lose this property for the
ingredients. Well, no, I don't lose the property for the ingredients. The ingredients are things which I choose and are fixed. Yeah. Right, so I choose that, and I'm then demanding that my flow starts from the physical theory of the Gaussian fixed point, and that the partition function is invariant of the flow. Now, if you start to generate non-local terms as a result of that, as lambda goes to zero, well, great, that's what the flow equation is telling you. But it's not restricting their appearance in that limit. I'm just demanding that my flow equation is well defined and that I'm flowing from the Gaussian fixed point.
Okay, but then how do you define G if you have such a... So this means this depends on the cutoff. So
G, yes, sure, my dependent. G is a non-universal object, but the beta function is not universal. If you're in a massless renormalization scheme, it's universal after two loops, non-universal beyond then, and if you're in a massive renormalization scheme, it's not even universal after that. So that far. So, sure, G is not a visible object, but it's just...
So, maybe you can explain, how are you going to get a 1 over box appearing in lambda 0 in a 0 which is expandable in derivative? What's the... You mean it's a 1 over box plus lambda or something like that? In general?
Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, these operators would be something you'd have to see being built up as you went to lambda goes to 0. I mean, in terms of doing an actual explicit calculation, I couldn't do that yet.
The partition function, you define it by a Feynman integral, I suppose. The partition function.
Right.
Okay. Does it bother you that you have the minus sign in the second term? Because that is unstable. That's an unstable term in your Feynman integral.
Right, indeed. So, again, I think the best at this stage I'll do is just refer you back to the paper on the regularization scheme. So where they say that there's a prescription, well, there's the prescription which can be interpreted in two different ways that I don't want to get into now, but we can discuss afterwards, whereby you can make sense of that. Mm. But yeah, it's a good point. So in fact, yes, I was just going to say, just to remind you, of course, you have got this minus sign, so you don't want to sweep it under the table, it's important, and it comes from sutras. The other thing that I think sometimes worth thinking about is you could also take the flow equation to be a definition of what you mean by the theory. And that's another way of looking at it. In that sense, the flow equation is perfectly well defined.
Yes, but does that allow you access to correlation functions or partition functions?
Yes, yes. Well, I certainly allow you access to correlation functions. Yes. So this comes from the supertrace. So you've got these two couplings, G2 and G2 squared. And just to note for the literature, one usually works with alpha instead, which is defined as the ratio of these two guys. So this thing, 1 over G2 squared, is written in this form. And the reason one chooses this is just so that it's G squared that's still counting your loops. It's a choice. It's a sensible one to make. So now do we have an even more complicated flow equation? So I've got two dimensionless couplings, G and G2, which renormalize separately. And in the broken phase, the flow equation has a single kernel for both A1 and A2. So the flow equation I worked down before when I was spontaneously breaking has got a single kernel left. This is not catastrophic, you can compute this, but it's not convenient. Now what let's do is better to generalize the flow equation further still. So that the flow equation can properly distinguish, if you like, between A1 and A2. So in other words, you want separate kernels for A1 and A2. And so this seems to make everything even more complicated if you've added all these ingredients. But from a diagrammatic expression perspective, it isn't. This is much more natural. And this comes back to the diagrammatic description I was talking about when you get rid of this A0 field. So here's to remind what the scalar diagrammatics were. So in a scalar field theory, these are diagrammatics, so these are n fields. So this is an n point vertex, and what you do is you distribute these fields on the left-hand side in all possible ways between the vertices. So if I've got two fields, I can put one here and one here, or do it the other way around. It's useful, as I've mentioned, to make this split of the action. And the diagrammatic form of the effective propagator relationship was this. So this is just the two-point vertex delta minus one, and this is just delta. So this is the diagrammatics that I'll use. The non-Arminian diagrammatics actually look almost exactly the same if I adopt this convenient prescription. So these fields F can be any of the fields, including the physical one and the regulator. I just exclude A0 because I said I've got rid of that to map me into this picture. They're distributed in all possible ways and they label the internal line. So in other words, if I've got an A1 here and an A1 here, this is an A1, A1 kernel. I'm going to have sufficient generality that I've got a different kernel for each propagating field. There's a prescription built into diagrammatics for evaluating group theory. And yes, and I've mentioned those points. So I'm going to just, to finish the diagrammatics, to revisit the effective propagator relation. So in U1 gauge theory, we had this, where we had the 1 minus the gauge remainder. And diagrammatically, I can write it like this. So obviously, the deltas are the same. And this triangle, I'm just going to take to represent the gauge remainder. This is just the notation I choose. And the non-abelian case is almost identical. The differences are the external field can be any of them, but the gauge remainder is defined for each external field. In other words, depending on what the external field is, depends on how I interpret this, how I write this now break equation. And the reason I put this line here, this is just some arbitrary structure, I just need to put that in actually to make sure that the group theory prescription makes sense. But the effect of propagation relation is otherwise the same. So I'm running a little bit late, so I've got a few transparencies left on putting quarks in, which I can either do or not. Does anyone want to see how to put quarks in?
Yes, no, yes.
OK, we'll put the quarks in. OK, fine, because this is actually quite cute. This is very cute. So the most obvious approach is to just embed the quarks in the superquark field. So you've got a physical field and an unphysical bosonic spinner. But the point is that the kinetic term will now violate this no-A-zero symmetry. And that's just because you're going to be left with a term that looks like psi A0. And that's a disaster. In fact, you can solve the constraint and it just sets all the fields to zero. So you can call it super quenched approximate. So this is the solution, and this is really neat. And it's to embed all the up-like quarks into one matrix and all the down-like quarks into another matrix. They're n by n. So you can see this is up and red, green, blue, obviously the colors going down and the flavors going across. And by doing this, what I've got is I've got an unphysical flavor symmetry, which is carried by the unphysical gauge field. Then what I do is I embed these guys into superfields, but these are the unphysical parts associated with it. And now I can just construct the no-A-zero symmetric term by taking the supertrace of this, well, just the usual kinetic term, but where I now take this to activate commutation. And because I can take it to activate commutation, one obviously commutes with everything, and that's what gets rid of the A0 term. And then finally, at the end of the day, you have to break the unphysical symmetry. Now, the reason this is really cute is as follows. So the procedure works for any number of quarks. You know, once the unphysical flavor symmetry is broken, you can give each quark its own mass, you can send the mass to infinity. But it's obviously most efficient if the number of quarks is equal to a multiple of n, because you've embedded, you know, the color down one thing and the flavor along the other one. So it's really too bad that the flavor symmetry is completely unphysical, it's carried by this wrong side gauge field. But it's still really appealing, I think, that the most efficient way to do this is if the number of quarks is a multiple of n. And the modification of the diagrammatics is just trivial. It looks exactly the same as before, but you just ensure that there's an independent exact logic curve for every propagating degree of freedom. And modify the group theory prescription appropriately. So I can now summarize. So the achievements to date, so the two-loop beta function was calculated in pure Yang-Mills without gauge fixing in 04. And I think that really confirms without, beyond reasonable doubt, that this construction makes sense. And it's an incredibly non-trivial calculation to get the right answer for it. I think it's a very powerful, it's not proof, but at least powerful argument. This is really good, which is making sense, because you couldn't fluke that. There was a universal calculus developed in perturbation theory, whereby in perturbation theory, almost all of these non-universal details, the details of the covariantization, the cutoff and so forth, disappear. There was a link made with ABS-CFT. Right. Let me get to the end. I've got an extra transparency on that, but I'll just go through. I'll go through the conclusions, and I can put up the extra transparency. So I developed the methodology for computing expectation values of gauge invariant operators. The one-loop beta function was computed for QCD. The extension of this calculus up here, non-perturbatively was found, and that's just the statement: you can remove many of these details, these non-universal details, non-perturbatively. And although it's not QCD, it's very closely related to the techniques that show that the QED beta function is actually resolvable.
What about confinement? Because it's non-perturbative. How do you formulate it?
Right, so the outlook. So I think that the framework is very appealing, due to the fact that you've got some manifest gauge invariants. You certainly understand how to perform efficient perturbative calculations, and I think in many cases, even doing a calculation of a specific thing in this form is in the standard form, if you understand what you're doing in this form, I don't think it's any harder. But understanding how best to apply the formulas beyond perturbation theories and non-perturbative problems, this is the real challenge. And the biggest problem is that generic truncations will spoil universality. And the difficulty with that is you've got this huge amount of extraneous junk which is sitting in here. And so I haven't really, I said that I want to keep my seed action general. I don't want to say what it is. I don't want to say what my covariantization is unless I have to, because if I leave it general, it should cancel out. But if I'm going to do some truncation, I'm going to have to get my hands dirty and say what all these things are. And then all the details which I've buried will come up to the surface. I'm going to have to deal with them. But the fact that I've got this universal calculus, which works non-materially, suggests that there are some major simplifications that are going on here. And my feeling is still, rather than just diving straight in and trying to compute and just getting bogged down in this, you know, huge amount of rubbish, it's worth spending the time to really properly understand the formulas and first, and to understand how to best go about computing before doing anything. And I think in particular, that supersymmetric theories offer a really very good framework for doing this, because much more is known about them non-determinatively. And so one can try to reproduce some of the results which are known, hence understand how to use ERG better. But I'm very hopeful that this won't be a passive process. In other words, I don't anticipate that one will just simply supersymmetrize and then just go through piece by piece trying to recover results that have been derived from the past. I think that there's new things which this can offer. So on that note, I think I'll finally finish this talk. Thanks.
Well, let's see more about the universality.
So this is just a very brief transparency, and this is not something which I have much expertise on, so I'll be brief. So this is the picture. So what I've got is I've got ND3 brains sitting here, which generate an ADS5 process 5 geometry. And surrounding them are N of these ghost D3 brains. So I think these were discovered by Takuda a few years ago, and they have negative tension, and they have no effect inside this shell, by Gauss's law. And outside the shell, they cancel the effect of these guys. So what was shown in the paper that discussed ghost D-brains is if you separate a stack of D3 brains from a stack of ghost D3 brains, you generate an SUN symmetry. Well, that's precisely what you need for a regularization. So you've got within the ADS-CFT correspondence, one would have a field theoretic understanding, a very precise field theoretic understanding of the regularization, how you can implement a gauge invariant regularization. And so this would hopefully shed light on the following issue. So in the ABCFT correspondence, the graph on the gravity side, the gravity doesn't know anything about the gauge invariant, so the cutoff should be automatically gauge invariant. But actually implementing a gauge invariant cutoff is a non-trivial thing to do. But this might offer a picture of how you really can do it in a manifest gauge invariant way that makes sense on both sides of the correspondence. But that's the comment on ABCFT. I think this would be a really interesting thing to explore further, but no additional work has been done on it.
What do you mean by the fact that the theta function of QED is the sum of them?
Precisely that. So, first of all, one needs to say what I mean by the coupling. So, if I define the coupling through my choice of exact RG, so it's I'm going to take a manifest gauge invariant of exact RG, and that will define for me what I mean by my coupling. That's one definition of the coupling. It will be different from the definition of MS bar, different from the definition of MS. But it is a definition of the coupling. Now, given that definition of the coupling, the beta function for that coupling is resummable.
How do you couple the fermions in QED?
What do you mean?
Quantum electrodynamics, you also should have some fermions there.
Right.
How do you couple them with this theory? Because you have twice the number of fields and blah, blah, blah. So
in U1 gauge theory, you don't have the problem of having to expand the gauge group. So in U1 gauge theory, U1 gauge theory of its own requires no complications at all. If you want to put quarks in, then you require one unphysical degree of freedom, so you require one Pauli Velas field. Mm-hmm. So it's quite straightforward. So it's just, you've got your physical gauge field, your physical electron field, and one unphysical bosonic spinner.
And do you encounter, for instance, the Landau ghost?
So the argument, it's a general argument that it can be resummed, the resummation hasn't been performed. So basically what you can do is you can look at it non-perturbatively, and you can show that non-perturbative power corrections cannot appear. So there's a general argument that they can't appear, so you suspect then that the series itself must be resummable. As to whether there's a Landau ghost would then depend on the result of actually performing the resummation.
I have one question concerning the initial starting point. Suppose I want to do the nice stuff, I take F, C delta F. Mm-hmm. And I compute perturbatively, you know, one loop diagram, I get a divergence. Mm-hmm. So this divergence presumably can be cancelled by adding a new term to the action. What
right.
is this term?
So the power of the last term, you mean?
No. Pure in terms of gauge. So what would be the term to add to cancel the
Sorry,
so you want to see any divergence corresponds to some type of effective action.
Right.
So what is the effective action in terms of A? This divergence correspond to?
What is the counter term in other words?
Yes.
So
what will be the form of the counter term for this divergence?
So I think it's asking this Pauli Villard's fields.
Yeah.
No, not the Pauli Villard.
They do the job. I mean, in principle, they're regularizing some divergence. This divergence correspond to a counter term in terms of the
A.
Usual variables.
Oh, I see. Right. So you want to know what counter term is?
Yes. To see exactly what this divergence means physically.
This leftover divergence.
Well, I would love it to be regularized by some type of mass term, because this is what confinement is about. So I want to see what this divergence is.
Well, hold on. So it would be most efficient if I actually got the.
I mean, perturbatively, you know, I guess you just could do it. I mean, it's going to be a gauge invariant quadratic counter term. What is it? If I take dimensional regularization and I look at all horse, you know,
I thought I had the paper here. Well, I don't actually have the paper.
So which paper is it?
Paper is the one by Arnone et al. From 2000. Well, the